You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me for the first time former New South Wales Supreme Court judge and author Michael Pembroke. He studied history, French, and politics at university, intending to become a diplomat, but instead he turned to the law and became a judge, undertaking a writing career in his spare time. Mr. Pembroke was born in Australia, but his first school was at Sandhurst, and his final university was at Cambridge in the UK. Michael has traveled extensively, lived in the United States, in the United Kingdom, and colonial Southeast Asia, as well as in Trump's America. He was in Washington, D.C. at the time of Watergate, Chicago, when the Obama legislature, the Obamacare legislation, was passed, New York City shortly before 9/11, and New Jersey during the first year of the Trump presidency, as I just noted. For his previous book, traveled through North Korea from the Yula River to the DMZ. In his new book, which is the subject of this discussion, America in Retreat, Michael Pembroke sketches the history of America's retreat from universal principles to provide a clear-eyed analysis of the dangers of American exceptionalism. Welcome, Michael, to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm really glad to have you with me.
Pleasure to be here, Jay.
Yeah, so you know, since World War II, America has thought of itself as an exceptional nation. We hear it all the time. It's sort of in our DNA now. We think that way. We've had a mission, it seems, we think, to create other countries in our own image. In what ways has America been an exceptional nation, and to what extent, if any, do you think exceptionalism still applies to America? Because I really think most Americans, they just really believe that we are an exceptional nation.
Well, America was certainly exceptional after World War II. It was the richest and most powerful country in the world. And it led the world in establishing the United Nations, in formulating the United Nations Charter, and a few years later in formulating the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But it's a great shame, I think, that in April 1945, Roosevelt died and the presidency passed to Harry Truman. Truman was a far more political man, old school, very hardline anti-communist, and things changed very rapidly. They almost unraveled after 1945. So, you know, take the Cold War, for example. Soviet Russia was on its knees. It was destroyed. It had suffered more than any other country. It was no threat to anyone. But under Harry Truman, the United States surrounded it with nuclear missiles and warheads and created the very threat that it professed to need protection against. In other words, when Soviet Russia was surrounded by nuclear missiles and warheads in the period 1947-48, it reacted in the way that you would expect. It started to spend money on creating its own nuclear warhead. Its first test of a nuclear warhead was not till 1949. And so, and there was no stage throughout the 1950s when the Soviet nuclear capability was anything like that of the United States, even though Americans were told, Americans of my parents' generation and your parents' generation were told that we're at risk at any time of being overrun by the Soviets. Yeah. It was unfortunately a great overreach. Mm-hmm. And overreach, I'm afraid, is what we saw then in the Korean War. The current book, but the last book I wrote about was about the Korean War, and it got me thinking along these lines. Its subtitle is "Where the American Century Began," Mm-hmm. And, you know, that war ought to have been over in the first 3 months, because the United Nations Security Council ruling was that the security of the border should be restored. That's what the collective forces of the US and the other allied forces set out to do. But and that was achieved after 3 months. We hear a lot about Pusan and the remarkable invasion on the West Coast that MacArthur engineered. But that was all in the first 3 months. And by about late September 1950, peace and security, if security at least, if not peace, had been restored at the 38th parallel. Mm-hmm. But then Harry Truman and Dean Acheson and others around them made a fateful decision. They wanted to engage in a process of regime change. So they, having complained about the North Koreans crossing the 38th parallel and heading south, they had no compunction about ignoring that border, crossing the 38th parallel, heading north, and trying to take out Pyongyang. Of course, China was nothing to do with that war at that stage. Mm-hmm. It was only when the US-led forces, and they represented 95% of the UN force, got right up to the Yalu River on the Chinese border at Manchuria, that China decided that it couldn't hold back anymore. So what was effectively a civil conflict, an attempt to reunify the country that had been divided by the Americans in 45, became a global conflict. And it made things worse. And the pattern has been repeated. I could go on,
yeah.
But you know, that they've created the very threat which they suggested in the first place they needed protection against.
Right. What do you think drove that? Why this regime change? Because this is a theme of America since then, actually, and most Americans aren't aware of our CIA's activity in various countries, as you outline in your book. You know, I've been aware because I'm a student of this sort of thing, but most Americans, it's certainly not part of something you're going to hear very much about. After all, we suggested that we don't want Putin anywhere near our elections. He better stay away from whatever goes on here. But as we, it's very well known and documented that the CIA has been very active in overthrowing governments and fomenting coup d'etats and so on and so forth. Eisenhower warned about the military-industrial complex, you noted in your book, and several other people who were concerned about an overreach, a military that became so dominant that it basically seems to control the politics. There was once upon a time when Democrats, at least a part of the Democrat Party, was not interested in this sort of military expedition overseas. But now they've also seemed to have joined, for the most part, this whole military-industrial complex that it seems to me Eisenhower was warning about. But why do you think? Is it just a monetary? Is it a money-grabbing thing? Is it? I mean, empires do these things, I realize. But why did, starting with Korea, why do you think we've been on this binge?
I think there's a propensity among Americans, or at least among the American elites in Washington, to see the world in black and white terms. An us and them approach. And that was very clear during the recent presidency of George Bush Jr. Mm-hmm. But it's been clear more or less all along, mm-hmm. Starting from Truman and going through for the 11 or 12 or 13 presidents since then. The Korea issue blew up because of a concern about communism, which was pervasive throughout the 50s and 60s. In more recent times, we've had a concern about Islamic regimes or radical Islam. And more recent times since, we've had a concern which President Biden expresses as authoritarian states against democratic states. It's all much the same, really. It's, you know, it's us and them. It's good and bad. It's binary, and it's not like that. You know, one of the most intelligent and clever government leaders around the world, I think, is Lee Hsien Loong, the Prime Minister of Singapore. Mm. And he has been saying to all the world leaders, starting at one of those global conferences about 3 or 4 years ago, the world is a very complex and diverse place. It's made up of all sorts of different states with different approaches, and there are many democracies which are you know, barely democracies, and there are many types of authoritarian states. We've just all got to live in a way in which we can accommodate each other. And we cannot assume that one is better than the other or one is right and the other is wrong. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't have any problem with standing up for human rights, you know, in different parts of the world. That's almost a separate issue. You can stand up and complain about what appear to be human rights abuses in Western China, but it doesn't mean that you shape your foreign policy around that and refuse to deal with China. Mm-hmm. Or assume that China is inferior to you. China actually has been fighting and dealing with the Uyghur problem in Western China, in Xinjiang, for 2,000 years. Well, not quite 2,000 years. They've been the Uyghurs only came into existence more recently than that, about 1,000 years ago. But before the Uyghurs, there were other problems with the inhabitants of the Xinjiang region in Western China. So it's been a constant concern for the Chinese. They deal with it differently to the way we deal with it. They're much more harsh with their citizens. That's not a reason to go to war with them. No. We didn't go to war with Germany because Hitler was abusing the Jews. It was because Hitler invaded Poland and threatened to invade the rest of Europe. So we've got to separate our moral concerns with the practical and pragmatic political issues that ought to govern our relationships with each other.
Yeah.
And so I'm all in favor of pragmatism, frankly, but that's ideology seems to be the dominant moving force in the United States and has been for 75 years.
Well, it is up until a point, and there comes a time when nations run into trouble. I believe that we're in some deep trouble financially in the United States with this massive deficit. So we've run these huge trade deficits, chronic trade deficits since we went off the gold standard in 1971. I believe that may be part of the need to have the world's reserve currency, to have enough liquidity sloshing around the world, that we intentionally almost ran trade deficits. It worked very well. The redistribution of wealth, I think, to the bankers and to government and so forth. If we could create money, we could finance Vietnam and we could finance Great Society program and so forth. So I sort of wonder if you would agree that there might be some connection there between when we went off the gold standard, we arranged with Saudi Arabia, we would protect the family, but we needed to have oil priced in dollars. So every nation that needed to import oil had to get dollars. And so there was a demand for dollars that didn't go away when we went off the gold standard. So I'm just wondering, we've gotten ourselves in this tremendous trade deficit. We're running these huge deficits. We can't raise interest rates anymore. They can't go up because we can't finance rates. There's concern about inflation. Meanwhile, China, as you point out in your book, is an ascending power. The One Belt, One Road initiative. It seems to me they're hooked. They took their trade surpluses and used it to build things. We were using borrowed money to create, to bomb countries, essentially, and change the regimes. It seems to me that we're approaching a day of reckoning, perhaps, in the United States. What are your thoughts?
Yes. You know that 2,000 years ago, Jay, there were two great empires in the world, the Roman Empire in the West and the Chinese Empire under the Han Dynasty in the East. They hardly knew each other, but they were beginning to trade with each other. At least China was sending silk to the West. Rome began to fall apart in the 3rd century of the period after Christ. Mm-hmm. Partly because it could no longer afford its empire of military bases, and partly because it had a huge imbalance of trade with China. Because It was spending all its bullion on buying massive amounts of silk and precious goods from China, whereas China was, for China, silk was a renewable and infinite resource. Mm-hmm. And there are similarities, I think, in what happened 2 millennia ago and what's happening today. Not quite the same, but I don't see how the United States can continue to afford the amount of money it spends on defence and security that at the moment, as you know, is equal to the next 9 or 10 countries in the world.
Right.
3 times more than China, for example, mm-hmm. And 10 times more than Russia, and many, many more times more than Germany, UK, other sophisticated countries. Mm-hmm. It also fosters a sort of militaristic outlook on the world, as if having a bigger army and a bigger empire of bases makes you a stronger and better country, when it clearly doesn't.
Yeah, and we've had this massive redistribution of wealth as well that I think has come as a result of our currency regime, but that's another topic. China is clearly an ascending power. I think it's hard to deny that, even if you want to. You mentioned in your book there are nations that are recognizing this and are working well with China. They are, America is hesitant to recognize this. We hear a lot of rhetoric from politicians how they must be stopped and so forth. But you mentioned in your book there are nations that are going to do quite well. I think you mentioned Europe should fare better than perhaps the U.S., South America even, and Africa. And, of course, all those countries that are linked up to the One Belt, One Road should do very well. I think that goes all the way into Europe, actually, I believe, using the waterways and the roads and so forth. It's an enormous enterprise that, while we were, as I said, using our resources to try to change governments, they were building things and trading, and we were consuming and they were saving. Another factor, I guess, that doesn't bode well if you live beyond your means decade after decade, sooner or later you have to pay the piper. So could you talk a little bit about the countries that you think are going to do, the regions of the world perhaps, that are going to do better than others with the, with China's ascension?
Yeah. Well, the whole of East Asia, frankly, recognizes, and frankly, that includes Japan, by the way, which is ambivalent. It's torn between United States and China, but it's historically, like most of East Asia, much more prepared to accommodate. They've got to live with each other. So there are benefits and opportunities from China's rise. There are some risks, but the smart players are positioning themselves to take advantage of the benefits and the opportunities. If someone is spending as much as China is spending on infrastructure, there are great opportunities to be had there. The other areas where you can see improvement and opportunity is right through the middle of Asia, right through the area from China to the west, through the Central Asian republics, and ultimately to the Mediterranean. Israel, of course, is such a staunch U.S. ally that it's unlikely to change. But Turkey and Iran, they're major, major supporters of China, and the same applies in Africa. China is all over Africa. It has been for the last decade or more. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that all happened while the rest of the world was asleep. You can't travel around Africa without seeing Chinese bridges and banks and institutions and Chinese workers. I mean, it causes some unhappiness in some places because the Chinese workers, sometimes keep to themselves and they don't employ African workers or indigenous people as much. But that's just, that goes with the territory. And the same applies in large parts of Central and South America. So while we've got the West, and by that I mean UK, Europe, North America, Australia, New Zealand, and there are attempts to bring in India and Japan, but they're not quite there, and they won't ever be quite there. While the West is resisting to some extent, it's a bit futile, I think. And clever countries like Germany and perhaps the European bloc more in general are hedging their bets. Mm-hmm. There's a lot to be gained from China's rise if you're pragmatic about it. If you're ideological and jump up and down about human rights abuses or what's happening in Taiwan, and you stay away and you seek to separate your country from China, well, you'll ultimately lose.
Yeah.
Boris Johnson said something the other day which I was pleased to hear about. He said, those who call for a new Cold War on China or for us to sequester our economy entirely from China are, I think, mistaken. We have a balance to strike, and we need to have a clear-eyed relationship with China. There are hawks in all countries, but I think the hawks are wrong on the China issue.
Yeah. Well, I must ask you, with just a few minutes left here, you mentioned the ambivalence of Japan with respect to China. I have to wonder about your country, where you are. Clearly, you have a lot of things to offer China, your raw materials and so forth. You are also, though, a close ally, as you just mentioned, with the United States. There must be some issues and some difficulties in balancing the two, because clearly the future where it is with China.
Yeah, there are huge difficulties, but at the moment we seem to be so much in the pocket of Washington that it seems to be all one way, and we've alienated China enormously. And we are seen as doing Washington's bidding.
Yeah.
At the moment. So Australia, unlike New Zealand, which is more independent-minded, is regarded in Asia as very conservative, very pro-American, and in a strangely contradictory position, because China's our largest trading partner.
Mm-hmm.
It's, I think, more than 60% of our exports go to China,
right.
Most of which is minerals which we dig out of the ground.
Yeah.
We need China, and we can benefit from that relationship. But at the moment, our current government is not as clear-eyed as Boris Johnson would suggest you need to be.
It's going to be interesting to watch, and of course very important which way things go with all these different geopolitical interactions. But aside from reading your book, American Retreat, people should read that. There's so much there. What would you say to people who are aware of China's ascension, individuals living, as I do, in America, or in your case, in Australia? How should we be preparing as individuals for what is to come? Because, you know, we can't control what our government does so much, but as individuals, what advice would you give people?
I think the most important thing is to get to understand China. To do that, you need to understand the history. If you can, you need to learn some of the language. If you can, you need to associate and deal with Chinese people. Right. We need to stop treating them as the enemy, as in fact Washington's strategic defense policy says.
Yeah.
They're not the enemy. They're a competitor.
Yeah.
But we need to deal with them and accommodate them and live with them and take from them what we can.
Indeed. And I think, you know, your youth, traveling as a young boy, various cultures around the world most certainly was influential in giving you a view of the world. I really appreciate this book, and I really love it. It's really a wonderful book. I'm really glad that you'd spend some time with us today to explain it, and we can't do justice to the book in a few minutes here, but I want to thank you very much for taking the time to share your thoughts with our listeners. It's very wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you, Jay, for the opportunity. I've enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you. Likewise.
Okay.
Well, folks, that is it for this week. Next week, Alistair McLeod of Gold Money will be with me, Dr. Quentin Henning, to discuss the Lion One Metals, and Patrick Highsmith to discuss Firefox Gold. Until then, goodbye, and God's blessings to you.
Thank you. Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
NV Gold Corporation, trading under NVX on the TSX and NVGLF on the OTCQB, is a gold exploration company focused on uncovering the next multi-million ounce gold deposit in Nevada with an aggressive exploration season ahead in 2021, a tight share structure, strong management ownership, key strategic investors, a globally recognized technical team, report coverage from industry gold experts, and a strong treasury. Visit NV Gold Corp.com to learn more on this exciting story.